Some of my introductory remarks, I think, should be on tape. This evening, I'm going to be giving a lecture about some things. Some of this will, a little bit of it will overlap with previous lectures that I've given. It will be in many ways a follow-up to a lecture I gave in January of this year, which is available, by the way, from She Who Remembers. That lecture was called Technology, Theocracy, and the Thousand-Year Reich. And also, this lecture will also be a follow-up to a certain extent to a lecture I gave this past spring called Fun with Science. This is called More Fun with Science. It's obviously a pointedly sarcastic name. What I'm going to be talking about is clandestine military research and clandestine military testing of some of the technologies that have been developed with that clandestine research. This is a program which is going to be, this is a lecture I should say, which is going to be dealing with a number of complex technological issues as such, and because I always strive to be as intellectually honest as I can be, unlike most of my lectures when I sit here and speak to you in my own words, I'm going to be doing a fair amount of that. I'm also going to be reading directly from some of the texts, precisely because when I'm going to be when I'm dealing with subjects which would involve aeronautical engineering, geophysics, electrical engineering, high energy physics, theoretical physics, and a lot of things which are not my native field, I think it would be intellectually dishonest for me past a point to comment about the subject material if I were not referring directly to it, precisely because I am not technically qualified past a point in these fields. I don't feel comfortable holding forth as I would on the subject of history per se. Although, the important part of this discussion is what we have to learn from studying the history of clandestine military research and testing, because as I think it was appropriately enough, a German 19th century German philosopher observed, history teaches us that we learn nothing from history. And I'm afraid that if we don't start, we are going to find ourselves in what George Bush used to refer to as deep doo-doo. And in fact, there are those among us, including yours truly, who would argue that we're in deep doo-doo as well, already in deep doo-doo. The title of the lecture is More Fun with Science, From Port Chicago to Project HARP. And we'll be talking about a number of clandestine military research and development projects, some of which have borne some rather obvious fruit. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about the covert application of some of these technologies and their use on unwitting American subjects, unwitting American citizens. I think that the implications of something like Project HARP could not be exaggerated. Project HARP is a project which is currently underway in Alaska, in which a very powerful array of electronic equipment is being used to heat up various segments of the ionosphere, and this in turn is supposed to produce a number of different effects. I am not qualified in the physics of the ionosphere, so I'm going to be reading again directly from some of the relevant texts. I can't say past the point what happens when you pour a whole bunch of ELF into the ionosphere and then use the resulting virtual antennas to reflect various kinds of electromagnetic radiation around the Earth and into the Earth. That it doesn't sound to me like a particularly good idea. And I'm afraid that, as Albert Einstein said, dealing with the atomic bomb, which is going to be the first subject up this evening, everything has changed but our way of thinking. And indeed, that's pretty much the theme or the underlying message of the lecture this evening. We now have the various types of technology which would have been envisioned as being accessible only to a supernatural being. The abilities that this gives us as a species would be viewed as capabilities that would only be accessible to a supernatural being some time ago. And yet we're not supernatural beings. We're still basically the same femur-cracking, marrow-sucking Neanderthals that we've always been. Only now we have things that really, we have toys that children shouldn't be playing with, and in my opinion, we still as a species are children. So again, this the talk this evening is going to be a little bit different than most of my other lectures because I want to stick very closely to the relevant text and some of what I have to say, precisely in order to maintain an optimum standard of intellectual honesty. for me to talk about ionospheric physics, or for me to talk about the research and discoveries of Nikola Tesla, for example, which I'm going to be touching on, would be intellectually dishonest if I were to present myself as an expert. I have read about these things, and in my head of your moment, I like to think I'm not stupid and that I can figure things out for myself, but it certainly is not my native field, and as such, I feel that as pedantic as it is, it's important for me not to stray too far from the text. Indeed, I think it's important for people who might feel the same degree of humility about many of these technologies to not be intimidated by one's own relative lack of information. Because even though you may not be an astrophysicist or a geophysicist or an electronics engineer or an electrical engineer, at the same time, I think that in examining some of the things that are going on right now, it is pretty clear that we are boldly going where no man has gone before. And I don't think the ending of the story is likely to be a happy one, given the nature of the beast, given the nature of the human animal. The first subject up, and by the way, I'm hoping that we have plenty of time this evening for questions from the listening audience or comments, and they need not necessarily have to do with the subject of tonight's lecture. For example, I've done work on the O.J. Simpson case, something nobody's heard of, right? If you want to ask some questions about that, and I think there's much, much more to that than meets the eye, we can talk about that a little later as well. Also, if people want to take a break, if I'm doing a Noam Chomsky, if I'm putting people to sleep, then they should feel free to set a small fire or throw something not too heavy or too sharp and preferably not too hard. Let me know, and we can take a break and perform whatever bodily functions people need to perform, or just stretch and clear out the intellectual cobwebs for what I hope will be a stimulating discussion. This past summer saw the 50th anniversary of the first official use of the atomic bomb on human beings, namely the atomic bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which ended World War II. There was an awful lot of media attention devoted to this. As is usually the case, an awful lot of that media attention missed a very, very important point. There was a very disturbing body of evidence indicating that the first use of an atomic bomb, the first deliberate use of an atomic bomb on human beings, was not Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And beyond that, there are very firm indications that the first Trinity test, or the Trinity test in Alamogordo, New Mexico, in July of 1945, was not the first test of an atomic bomb. Just out of curiosity, so I have an idea of how many of you are at least marginally familiar with the subject of Portugal, how many of you listen to Roy Tuckman's show on Wednesday night? How many of you have heard some of the previous discussion about Port Chicago? Some of you, but by no means all of you. Okay. Some years ago, I came across an article from a publication called The Black Scholar, which is a quarterly publication which is out of Oakland, California. It's still in existence. And this article was entitled The Last Wave from Port Chicago. It was authored by a fellow named Peter Vogel, last name V-O-G-E-L. And in it, Peter Vogel presented a hypothesis which turned out to be basically correct, although it has undergone some revisions. And now I think Peter has indeed hit ground zero with one of the most profound and important political and scientific investigations of the 20th century. And a political and scientific investigation which, sadly, has gone largely unrecognized by an awful lot of people. Certainly, that motley crew of well-intentioned, though not particularly knowledgeable or overly bright in many cases, a group of activists who comprise the so-called progressive sector. I call them the peace mafia, because really the progressive sector is governed by a very small number of people. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, The Nation magazine, Z magazine, Noam Chomsky and his camp followers, and the Pacifica National Management. And that's pretty, Political Research Associates, let's not forget them. That pretty much dominates the progressive political sector, and they keep going over the same old thing. They have the fetish of the week. It's Haiti, or it's the Palestinians. Used to be South Africa, but not anymore. Free Nelson Mandela was one of their cries. And this is not to say that many of these causes are not worthwhile. But there's an awful lot that's going on, and none of these SOBs ever talks about it. And some of the things that are going on are a hell of a lot more important than some of the things they tell you about. And unlike an awful lot of the things they tell you about, some of the things that are going on that you don't hear about are going to result in the demise or serious unhappiness, either of you or some of the people close to you. And that's why I think it's important to stray from the beaten path, something they don't do. It's also one of the reasons why I'm very critical of the so-called progressive sector, and that's why I call them the so-called progressive sector, which leads some people to conclude that I must be a right-winger. That's another reason why I call it the so-called progressive sector. An awful lot of them, frankly, couldn't tell a dirt road from a chicken with lips. And as is the case, an awful lot of the time this past summer, in the surfeit of media attention and the sometimes heated debate concerning Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and should we have dropped the bomb, and was it moral to do that to those poor old Japanese, I think there are serious questions about whether the first atomic bombs should have been dropped on Japan for the reasons they were dropped, which was basically to scare them out of the Soviet Union. That's why they were really dropped. I personally would have had, if I'd been in Harry Truman's position, I would have dropped the bomb. You know, the Japanese were not the world's greatest party animals in that particular period of time. It's funny because the liberals get all worked up about the atomic bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and did they constitute war crimes, and look at the terrible things we did to those non-combatants. Most liberal Americans do not know about something called the Rape of Nanking, which took place in 1937, in which more than twice as many Chinese were put to death as Japanese lost their lives in both atomic bombings combined. This was done over a period of several days, and they weren't the hundreds of thousands of Chinese who died in Nanking were not incinerated by a high-altitude aerial bombing of a high-tech weapon. They were done in by being bayoneted, shot at point-blank range, beheaded, beaten to death, eviscerated. In other words, as Marcia Clark said, up close and personal. And this is more than twice as many Chinese died at the Rape of Nanking as Japanese died in both atomic bombings put together. More Germans died at Dresden. There were a number of conventional bombings. More Japanese died in the firebombing raids and the incendiary raids on Tokyo than died in the atomic bombings. But the debate has focused on the atomic bombings and did it constitute a war crime or what have you. As I say, I think in light of the way the Japanese behaved in World War II, I think that some of that hand-wringing is misplaced. It's not to say that I sanction the killing of non-combatants, but it's a way of life now in modern war, and certainly the Japanese and Germans didn't hesitate at such a thing, and they were far more cruel at it than the United States or Britain or even the Soviet Union ever was. Certainly lost in the debate about Hiroshima and Nagasaki was an incident called Port Chicago, or that has come to be known to those who are familiar with as Port Chicago. The Port Chicago explosion, according to official history, constitutes the explosion of an ammunition ship, the E. A. Bryan. It was a Liberty ship, and it was parked in Suisun Bay, or it was anchored, I should say. That tells you I'm a landlubber, right? You don't park a ship. It was anchored at Suisun Bay at the Sacramento River Delta in the San Francisco Bay Area. This was a major naval base. It's now part of the Concord Naval Weapons Station. And the E. A. Bryan was an ammunition ship, and on the evening of July 18, 1944, that ship exploded, and hundreds of black sailors who were loading ammunition aboard it were killed, along with some of their marine guards. The Port Chicago explosion has become a celebrated event in the history of American civil rights, because there was an enormous mutiny afterward, because many of the black sailors were outraged and terrified at what had happened to their compatriots, who were incinerated, basically. And they refused to continue to load ammunition at this particular naval base. They were then court-martialed and convicted of mutiny. This stood as a major football, if one could call it that, in the American civil rights struggle. Advocates for African Americans long maintained that those sailors had been unjustly tried and that they should have had their mutiny convictions overturned by the Navy. The Navy refused to do that and refuses to do that even to this day. The considerable issues of civil rights in the Port Chicago explosion have come to be what that event is known for in American history, whereas the real significance of the Port Chicago explosion, to my way of thinking, and I think the evidence stands behind that, is that in all probability, in fact, I will say at this point, with all certainty, it has now been established that Port Chicago was not the accidental explosion of a conventional ammunition ship, that what was exploding in the EA, in the hold of the EA Bryan, what devastated that ship, it completely destroyed the ship. No recognizable piece of that vessel was ever found, although there were a few shards of metal that various people have claimed since were part of the EA Bryan. That ship was totally blown to smithereens, and the evidence suggests very strongly at this point that that ship was actually destroyed by a type of atomic bomb known as the Mark II, which was actually known as the full title of it. I'm going to perhaps refer to some notes. It's called the, I forgot what the first part of the title is. It's one of these very, very long names. It's actually a uranium hydride implosion device. It was a very, very crude atomic bomb, the first atomic bomb, and something which represents something of an unknown chapter in the development of nuclear weapons. I'm going to outline some of the basic features of the Port Chicago investigation. The reason I'm discussing Port Chicago is that in our lifetimes, the atomic bomb and its successor, the hydrogen bomb, have rightfully assumed their place as the most fearsome and destructive weapons ever developed, or at least up until some things that are looming on the horizon or may have actually been unleashed. I suspect that AIDS may actually not be an accidental or natural disease, but the application of genetic engineering to the art, if one could call it that, of biological warfare. I talked about that in a lecture that I gave this past April. That's available from She Who Remembers. I've also given a lecture just on AIDS. However, at least up until AIDS and possibly Project HARP, if it turns out to be what some people are afraid it might be, the atomic bomb was the most ferocious and destructive, nuclear weapons, I should say, are the most ferocious and destructive instruments ever used in the, or introduced into the annals of American, or of human warfare. And it's worth noting that the available evidence suggests very strongly that this device, which was being developed clandestinely in the 1940s, was in fact tested, deliberately tested, on American citizens, albeit African Americans, individuals viewed by the establishment of that time, and I would say since that time, as inferior citizens, as second-class citizens, and consequently appropriately designated for that type of thing. The evidence suggests that the atomic bomb was first deliberately tested on American citizens. And that, I think, is a very important lesson for us to understand, because the record proves that other military technologies have been clandestinely tested on American citizens. If there are people that find the idea of deliberately setting off an atomic bomb and killing a bunch of black sailors to be preposterous or outrageous, just think about all the publicity about the radiation experiments that were conducted on American citizens in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Think about the troops that were marched up to Ground Zero in the 1950s and then were told to, quote, observe, unquote, atomic explosions. Actually, what the Defense Department was doing was testing the effects of those explosions and the radiation on the troops. Many of the troops who witnessed those explosions eventually sickened and or died as a result of the radiation. The same thing is true of people who experienced were the human guinea pigs in some of these radiation experiments. Some of them became quite ill, and some of them apparently have died as a result of that. From a moral standpoint, there's no difference in experimenting on a human being and inflicting a condition on them which causes them to sicken and die over a period of 20 years, and experimenting on them and using a technology on them which incinerates them in the blink of an eye. The only difference is the speed with which they die and perhaps the amount of suffering that they experience on the way out. So, in evaluating Port Chicago, if there are people to whom the idea of deliberately setting off a nuke on American citizens is unacceptable from an intellectual standpoint, and I appreciate that. This is not to be judgmental. Just think about things that you already know about. You know that they tested radiation on people. You know that they marched troops up to Ground Zero. As we'll touch on in a second, it is also a matter of public record that biological agents have been tested on American citizens. A barge was towed around San Francisco Bay in 1950 spraying Serratia marcescens bacteria all over the place. Serratia was, we were told, is a harmless bacterium. It is for people who are young and healthy and with immune systems that are working in an optimum fashion. For senior citizens or people whose immune systems are otherwise compromised, Serratia marcescens can be a deadly infective agent, and in fact, fatal Serratia infection is a major cause of death among senior citizens with impaired immune systems. And surprise, surprise, the San Francisco Bay Area is the part of the country with the largest incidence of Serratia infection, even to this day. A barge was towed around San Francisco Bay by the Navy in an experiment for 3 days, and the thing was spewing Serratia marcescens up into the atmosphere. There was a lawsuit by a fellow whose grandfather died of Serratia infection. He believes because of that experiment, he did not win the lawsuit. But again, as we examine Port Chicago, for people to whom that might be a very difficult idea to accept, just think about other things which are better known than Port Chicago, which is relatively obscure, and ask yourselves what difference there is between using one type of clandestine technology on people, which would produce death over a period of months or years, or another type of technology which would incinerate somebody in the blink of an eye. It might, as terrible as it sounds, it might actually be kinder to vaporize somebody than to inject them with something that's going to produce a slow death. But there's nothing from a moral standpoint any different between injecting people with radiation, marching them up to ground zero so they can, quote, observe, unquote, an atomic explosion, really so they can be observed during the course of this test to see how the radiation affects them, and Port Chicago. The Port Chicago story really begins with an accident. Peter Vogel, again, the individual who wrote the article, The Last Wave from Port Chicago, was working as a consultant at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, and he was at a church rummage sale, and in the bottom of a box full of photographic equipment that he purchased, he came across some documents, which, as it turns out, were classified documents from the Los Alamos National Laboratory, where the atomic bomb was developed, and they had somehow been stolen and had found their way into this box of documents that Peter obtained quite by accident. As he began going through the documents, which referred to the history of the 10,000-ton gadget, it was basically a description of the Trinity test. At one point in describing the mushroom cloud that went into the air during the Trinity test, the mushroom cloud, the cloud was said to mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. And Peter, who was quite knowledgeable about the development of nuclear weapons, and again a consultant, working as a consultant to Los Alamos National Laboratory, he had been a student of Edward Teller's. And by the way, remember the name Edward Teller. We're going to see him in old and new guises during the course of the discussion this evening. Of course, Edward Teller is known as the father of the hydrogen bomb. He also was deeply involved in the development of the atomic bomb, and as it turns out, was centrally placed in the development of the Mark II uranium hydride weapon, which ultimately was used at Port Chicago. But Peter was fascinated by this. He'd never heard about Port Chicago. He began making inquiries, and he was told to look it up on the encyclopedia under disasters, and he did. And he then learned about the explosion of the E.A. Bryan on July 18th of 1944. He could not understand why the Trinity test was referred to as mushrooming out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. According to the official history, Port Chicago was the explosion of an ammunition ship. So he went to his former teacher, Edward Teller. At one point, Peter had been a student of Edward Teller's, and he showed him this document and asked him to explain what Port Chicago had to do with nuclear weapons or with the atomic bomb. Edward Teller became extremely defensive, and he said, "I will deny ever having read this document. I will deny ever having spoken to you about Port Chicago. What you have there is a classified document. You should take it straight to the authorities of Los Alamos so that it can be reclassified. You should not be looking at this." Obviously, there was something extremely sensitive about Port Chicago for Edward Teller. He would not acknowledge to Peter that he said, "I will not acknowledge ever having seen these documents or ever having spoken about Port Chicago with you." Later, Peter learned that Edward Teller was centrally positioned in the research and development which resulted in the development of the uranium anhydride implosion weapon, or Mark II, sort of a primitive atomic pipe bomb that was the first atomic bomb, not the U-235 gun weapon or the plutonium weapon which were used respectively on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but a nuclear weapon which was only used once because it was very primitive and turned out to be relatively inefficient, although a hell of a lot more efficient than any conventional explosives, that was the Mark II. That was what was used at Port Chicago. So Peter began making inquiries, and his initial development, or his initial research into Port Chicago, focused on the possibility that Port Chicago may have been a test of the gun weapon. Now, the early atomic weapons were known as Mark I and Mark III. Those are Roman numerals, 1 and 3. The Mark I was the type of weapon that was used on Hiroshima. That was the so-called little man. That was literally a breech weapon. It was called the gun weapon because one projectile of enriched uranium is literally fired down an unrifled 5-inch naval gun barrel in the initial design, and then strikes another larger piece of enriched uranium, and the critical mass is achieved, the chain reaction is achieved by reaching critical mass by firing the one piece of uranium into the other. That's how the critical mass is achieved, and the chain reaction resulting in the nuclear explosion is achieved. Basically, it's a uranium gun. The so-called little man that was dropped on Nagasaki is elongated in shape, hence the name little man, because it is a gun. That is how critical mass is achieved. That is how the explosion is produced. That is the Mark I. The Mark III is the so-called fat man weapon. That is the plutonium implosion device. Basically, that is a spherical device in which the fissionable material is plutonium, and it is brought to critical mass by exploding a series of highly sophisticated explosive panels which are shaped concentrically to surround the fissionable material. These are detonated simultaneously. They explode inward, imploding the mass of plutonium and bringing it to critical mass in that fashion and producing the chain reaction and the explosion. That's the Mark III or Fat Man that was used on Nagasaki. It's called a Fat Man because it's basically cylindrical, spherical, in shape. No, the plutonium weapon was used on Nagasaki. The gun weapon was used on Hiroshima. Hiroshima was first. That was the little man or gun weapon in which critical mass is achieved by firing a mass of enriched uranium into another mass down a 5-inch naval gun barrel. The fat man is round in shape because that has a series of explosive panels which implode plutonium. That's the Mark III. Most researchers in the history of the atomic bomb never asked why there was no Mark II, because in fact there was, as we'll see in a couple of minutes. Peter's initial line of inquiry into Port Chicago examined the possibility that the Port Chicago explosion, which for reasons we'll examine in a minute, might very well have been a test of the U-235 gun weapon, the enriched uranium gun weapon, which officially was never tested before it was actually used on Hiroshima. According to the official history of the development of the bomb, the first time the gun weapon was used was when it was actually dropped on Hiroshima. The official explanation for that, and as that turns out from Peter's research, that it was a lie, was that there was not enough enriched uranium available at that time to both conduct a successful test and later to use it on Hiroshima. Later, Peter learned through Freedom of Information Act documents that, in fact, there was plenty of enriched uranium around, that they very well could have tested it, that was simply an official lie. That spurred Peter's interest. He then proceeded along his path of inquiry, which increasingly was leading him to suspect that on the E.A. Bryan there had been a U-235 gun weapon, and that actually this had either been an accidental explosion or perhaps a deliberate test of the gun weapon. Now, there are a number of things which suggest that the official explanation for Port Chicago, namely that an ammunition ship exploded, could not possibly have been the case. In the first place, the amount of damage that was done to the ship, to the dock, and the amount of material that was scooped out of the bottom of Suisun Bay simply could not be accounted for by what would normally be expected for the explosion of the detonation of conventional explosives aboard an ammunition ship. It would be impossible for all of the conventional explosives on board of the E.A. Bryan to have gone off at once high order. When conventional munitions are detonated, They don't all go off at once. You get sort of a firecracker effect, and they will actually explode over a period of time. Explosives experts consulted by Peter said that no more than 30% of the munitions on board the E.A. Bryan would have detonated at one time. The rest would have either been blown all over the place. In fact, they found large numbers of 5-inch naval shells, for example. Many of them melted from the extreme heat, but they were undetonated. The point is that only 30% of the explosives would have gone off high order. Many of them would have burned or otherwise been damaged, but not gone off high order. So the extreme damage could not be accounted for by the detonation of the conventional munitions that were supposedly on board the E.A. Bryan, which was carrying a cargo of torpedoes and depth charges and naval artillery shells, basically TNT and Torpex. Also, the characteristics of the explosion are markedly different from what would be expected from the explosion of those types of munitions. Those types of munitions, TNT and Torpex, give off a yellow glow when they explode, yellow or orange flash. All of the eyewitnesses to the Port Chicago explosion, and there were many of them, all described a brilliant, blinding white flash. The papers in Napa, for example, 23 miles away from Port Chicago, and on the other side of a range of mountains, a small mountain range, said that for a brief moment, the entire Napa Valley was illuminated as bright as daylight by this explosion. The explosion of TNT and Torpex would not have done that. Beyond that, the brilliant white flash that was described by all of the eyewitnesses is characteristic of the extreme heat of a nuclear explosion, not the type of detonation that would occur with TNT or Torpex. Beyond that, all of the eyewitnesses, particularly airplane pilots, military pilots who had a chance to witness the explosion, described what they called a smoke ring around the explosion. This almost certainly was something called a Wilson condensation cloud. And a Wilson condensation cloud, which looks like a smoke ring around an atomic explosion, around the mushroom cloud, is produced by low-yield atomic weapons detonated in a marine environment. Because in a place like California, or in your best chance of actually seeing a film of a Wilson condensation cloud around a nuclear explosion is if you see photographs or motion picture footage of the Bikini or Eniwetok tests. In a warm atmosphere, you have water vapor, which is contained in the atmosphere. When a nuclear explosion occurs in an area where there's water vapor in the atmosphere, the compression and rarefaction of the atmosphere causes that water vapor to condense in a cloud around the central explosion. If you see a photograph of the Bikini test or a motion picture footage, you'll see there's a circular cloud around that. That's characteristic. That Wilson condensation cloud is characteristic of the detonation of low-yield atomic weapons in a marine environment. You won't see that on dry land or in the middle of the Nevada desert. It doesn't happen. But it does happen when such a device is tested in a marine environment. And obviously, at Port Chicago, at Suisun Bay, this was a marine environment. Also, it was in California in the middle of July as well. So the smoke ring described by eyewitnesses, in all probability a Wilson condensation cloud, cannot be adequately explained by any other physical scenario other than an atomic weapon. The most compelling thing to me, however, the most compelling body of evidence concerning Port Chicago is not just the physical evidence. And we should note, first of all, that there was enough enriched uranium on hand to make perhaps 10 or 11 weapons, so they certainly did have enough uranium on hand to test an atomic bomb. So the official version as to why the U-230, why the gun weapon was never tested, does not hold water, no pun intended. Also, the destructive force of Port Chicago cannot be accounted for by the detonation of the conventional munitions on board that ship. The physical characteristics of the explosion, in particular the blinding white light, and the, quote, smoke ring, unquote, which surrounded the explosion, cannot be accounted for by the detonation, of conventional munitions on board an ammunition ship. A nuclear explosion is the most likely explanation for those various pieces of observed physical phenomena. But the most interesting aspect to me, and again, I want to stress that I'm not someone who is technically qualified in these fields. I can read the literature and decipher it up to a point. It's why in examining such things as Tesla technology, we're going to touch on UFOs this evening. I'm going to be reading directly from some of the texts because when we get into some of the technical aspects of the physical sciences, I am not on my home turf. And again, I think it would be intellectually dishonest for me to hold forth on that past a point. But I am an experienced political and historical researcher. And when I step in a cow flop, I can tell you it stinks. And with regard to the Port Chicago explosion, it is pretty obvious that the official version of that will not hold water, and that, in fact, a cover-up was underway with regard to Port Chicago. And the historical evidence about the Port Chicago explosion I find very, very compelling. Now, in the first place, as I mentioned, there was enough uranium, enriched uranium on hand, to build a gun weapon. So the official explanation as to why the gun weapon was never, quote, tested, unquote, doesn't hold water. It just won't wash. Beyond that, Peter Vogel chanced to come upon a piece of film which, as far as he could tell, was an actual film of the Port Chicago explosion. And in fact, this is how it was initially represented to him, that this was a film of Port Chicago. There are some people who have argued that Port Chicago was an accidental explosion, that, yeah, it was a nuke, but that it was accidentally set off. I don't buy that for a number of different reasons, and we'll go into that. Ask yourselves how likely it is that someone would be filming an ammunition ship being loaded at 10 o'clock at night from the other side of the bay, and not only being loaded by black sailors, too, at 10 o'clock in the night. You're not going to see a whole lot. It's not going to be one of the more enriching and enlightening visual experiences of one's lifetime. And yet, there was a very obvious motion picture of the Port Chicago explosion. And this is how it was initially represented to Peter Vogel. In the flash, and then the mushroom cloud, the Wilson condensation cloud. As Peter began to delve into the subject of Port Chicago, a cover-up began. And one of the aspects of this cover-up was a misrepresentation of this particular motion picture footage. When the Navy added Port Chicago to the Concord Naval Weapons Station, they argued that because of the mountains surrounding Port Chicago, it would be an ideal site to berth Navy ships because a nearby nuclear explosion would be shielded from the ships by these mountains. And they represented this particular footage as being something that was done in a movie studio, a simulation in a movie studio of what would happen if there was a nuclear explosion at Port Chicago. Now, simply because of things, details like the Wilson condensation cloud, for example, Peter was very skeptical that the average movie studio technician would know enough about a nuclear detonation to include a Wilson condensation cloud in an aquatic explosion. And after examination, Peter discovered that the film was made on nitrate-based film, which was discontinued in either 1949 or 1950, long before this film was supposedly made in a movie studio in the early 1960s. So again, we have deliberate dissembling on the part of the authorities. Although this film strip was represented as a movie studio simulation made in the early 1960s of what would happen if a nuke went off at Port Chicago, in fact, the film was segment was on nitrate-based film, and that was discontinued many, many years before this was made, because it was highly flammable. A lot of movie theaters would burn down in the old days because it was nitrate-based film. It was highly flammable. Actually, it could explode. So when one sees an official entity engaging in what obviously is a cover-up, you can assume that they're not engaging in a cover-up for no good reason. Maybe you've seen some of the old Warner Brothers cartoons where Bugs Bunny is going through a haunted house and he'll knock on a door, you know, and they go, anybody in there? And a voice comes out, no, there's nobody in here. It's sort of similar. Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley researcher, has noted that frequently the cover-up will obviate the conspiracy. When there's a cover-up going on, isn't it? You never have a cover-up going on for no reason. And I think the Scott methodology applies very nicely in the case of Port Chicago. Why, for example, would the Navy be lying about the amount of fissionable, the amount of enriched uranium on hand? There's no reason to lie about that ordinarily. Why would they lie about the nitrate-based film? Again, people would, there's no reason to lie about that if there's nothing to hide. Beyond that, Peter's article came out in the spring of 1982, in the spring 1982 edition of Black Scholar, a quarterly. And shortly after that, the Army and Navy Explosive Safety Board Technical Paper Number 6 on the Port Chicago explosion was reclassified top secret. This was the explosion of a World War II ammunition ship in 1944, and yet, after Peter's article was published in the spring of 1982, almost 40 years later, this report was reclassified top secret, and regular civilian researchers, including Peter, could not get access to it. Ask yourselves why. What could conceivably be so controversial about what is supposedly is a very mundane event? What conceivable reason would the Navy have to reclassify the explosion of a World War II ammunition ship top secret almost 40 years after the end of World War II? And yet that's just exactly what happened to the Army and Navy Explosive Safety Board Technical Paper Number 6, which is quite a mouthful. Beyond that, it is quite interesting to see some of the things that happened to Peter Vogel. One set of his notes was stolen. He fortunately had a number of different copies of his documents stashed in various places. At first there was a burglary in his house and a number of things were taken, some of them valuables. But also the paperwork, all of his paperwork on Port Chicago was ripped off. He had a backup set of notes in a storage area ripped off. He had another one secreted with a friend. At one point, Peter was in his house and I guess his residence at the time had a plate glass window, and somebody driving a four-wheel drive vehicle drove right through his plate glass, his picture window, into his living room. The guy hopped out of the driver's seat and ran right to where his Port Chicago papers were stashed, grabbed them, and then ran out the back door, which is a pretty interesting occurrence. Ask yourselves how many times something like that has happened to you. Indicating that somebody was extremely displeased with Peter's research. And again, this happened in the early 1980s. That's not your usual state of affairs. So again, I think in the case of Port Chicago, the cover-up, to a certain extent, obviates the conspiracy. And again, as a veteran political and historical researcher, it is the historical evidence that I find most compelling. I could understand the physical evidence, the Wilson condensation cloud, the blinding white flash, and some of the other things I've gone into. But when I see something like the reclassification of the report on Port Chicago top secret 40 years later, when I see what happened to Peter with this clown driving his four-wheel drive vehicle right into the guy's, through the guy's picture window, hopping out and doing just what everybody would do under those kinds of circumstances, running and grabbing Peter's papers and heading on out the back door. When I see the reclassification, when the film is supposedly being made in the early 1960s, when that type of film was discontinued in terms of manufacture, 1949, 1950, something is going on. Something is rotten in Denmark. Beyond that, there was a tremendous amount of interest. Beyond that, there was a tremendous amount of interest in the Port Chicago explosion by the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And specifically, a fellow named Captain William Parsons, P-A-R-S-O-N-S, a captain in the United States Navy, was immediately dispatched to Port Chicago to do a lengthy and detailed investigation of the Port Chicago explosion for the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Parsons was a very interesting fellow. Most conventional histories of the development of the atomic bomb have it that the bomb was developed by the Army, and General Leslie Groves is the figure that usually is cited as sort of the godfather of the atomic bomb. In fact, the first envisioned use of the atomic bomb was as a shipborne weapon. It was initially seen as being brought into a harbor city by a boat and detonated in a harbor, sinking ships and sending shockwaves and inflicting a large amount of damage to the adjacent areas around the port. The Navy was deeply involved in the development of the atomic bomb, in particular the gun weapon, and Captain William Parsons was in charge, basically, with developing the gun weapon and was the single most important and highest-ranking military officer at Los Alamos. He actually had more power than General Groves, and he was a captain in the United States Navy. Later, William Parsons became the bombing officer aboard the Enola Gay that dropped the gun weapon on Hiroshima. He also was in charge of the Eniwetok tests and Operation Crossroads, the bikini tests as well. So the name Captain William Parsons is not one of the better known names in the history of the development of American nuclear weapons, and yet he was one of the very one of the most important and the most significant military officer at Los Alamos. 2 days after Port Chicago, William Parsons goes to Port Chicago to begin a lengthy and detailed report on this explosion for Los Alamos. Now again, why in bloody hell would Los Alamos want to know anything about the explosion of an ammunition ship? Such phenomena were very well documented. Ammunition ships had blown up plenty of times. A top secret U.S. military facility engaged in the development of the atomic bomb would not need to know anything about an explosion of an ammunition ship. That was a very well documented phenomenon, and yet there was an inordinate amount of interest in the Port Chicago explosion. And William Parsons completed his report on August 4th of 1944. Very shortly thereafter, the Los Alamos project converted from focus on the U-235 gun weapon to focus on developing the explosive panels for the plutonium implosion device. Recall that the Fat Boy, the plutonium weapon used on Nagasaki, reached critical mass by having a series of explosive panels. It was spherical in shape. Those explosive panels detonated simultaneously inward, imploding the plutonium and causing it to hit critical mass and the chain reaction and nuclear explosion beginning. Right after Parsons' report, in August of 1944, the month after Port Chicago, the main emphasis at Los Alamos switched to the development of the plutonium weapon. This initially led Peter Vogel to conclude that it was the U-230, it was the gun weapon that was detonated at Port Chicago. However, as Peter began pursuing his research, he came across a weapon called the Mark II. Now remember that the gun weapon was called the Mark I. The plutonium weapon, that was used at Hiroshima, the Mark I. The plutonium weapon was the Mark III. That was dropped at Nagasaki. Well, obviously, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes or Albert Einstein to figure out that there's an anomaly there. Why do you go from Mark I to Mark III? What happened to Mark II? There were a few references in the literature that Peter Vogel came across to the Mark II. Finally, as he began to, his interest was piqued, he began doing research into the Mark II and came across the fact that in fact there was a third type of atomic weapon. It was actually the very first to be deployed, as we shall see, and it was in all probability, almost certainly, this type of weapon that was used at Port Chicago. The Mark II, because the full name was the Autocatalytic Uranium Hydride Implosion Weapon. It's probably why they decided to call it the Mark II. That's a mouthful. What this basically consisted of, one of the advantages of this type of weapon, although it was not nearly as efficient as either the Mark I or the Mark III, was that you could use regular uranium. You didn't have to enrich the uranium. It was mixed with hydrogen so that you had uranium hydride, and it was basically sort of like an atomic pipe bomb. Layers of conventional explosive and uranium hydride were sandwiched together in basically a cylindrical form. It was like a pipe bomb. When the conventional explosives were detonated, this caused the uranium hydride to reach critical mass and a nuclear explosion, an atomic explosion, resulted. Again, it was called the Autocatalytic Uranium Hydride Implosion Weapon, or Mark II, only used once and relatively inefficient as nuclear weapons go. Peter came across this, and beyond that, as he began to examine the correspondence that took place among some of the many principals in Port Chicago, he came across some information which was both very fascinating and, from an investigative standpoint, I think altogether compelling. On July 17, 1944, now that was the day before the Port Chicago explosion before Port Chicago exploded, James B. Conant, that's C-O-N-A-N-T, he was at that time was the president of Harvard University and one of the central academicians involved in the U.S. Atomic Weapons Development Program, was corresponding with J. Robert Oppenheimer, usually viewed as the father of the atomic bomb, and J. Robert Oppenheimer suggested a test of the Mark II, so that we should test out the Mark II to see if it's combat viable, if we can actually make this thing work in a combat situation. This was July 17th, 1944. The next day, Port Chicago happened. Coincidence? Possibly. But what is even more fascinating than that was on August 3rd, 1944, there was another letter, and again, Peter got a hold of these, another letter from Oppenheimer to Conant suggesting that I've forgotten the exact wording because I'm operating from memory, but suggesting that we were now about to get some fruitful information, that our research efforts with regard to the Mark II are about to yield their first successful fruits. So we are now about to get the first information about how successful the Mark II might be. Now, officially, at this point, the Mark II should not have been, there should be no information about the Mark II, because according to the official history, the Mark II wasn't set off. Remember, this was August 3rd, 1944. The next day, August 4th, was when Parsons handed in his completed report on Port Chicago. Oh, a detail I've forgotten. Well, in addition to his many other interesting credentials, and remember, Parsons was in charge of the development of the gun weapon. He's the bombing officer aboard the Enola Gay. He's in charge of the Eniwetok and Bikini Atoll tests. He is the highest-ranking military officer in terms of the pecking order at Los Alamos, outranking Leslie Groves. He also was the individual who, 2 days after Port Chicago, was dispatched by Los Alamos to write a detailed investigative report on Port Chicago, also in correspondence obtained by Peter Vogel and also David Call, an associate of his. William Parsons was very emphatic in stating that the atomic bombs should be tested on human beings, that the most important aspect of the research into the use of these weapons was the effect that they would have on human beings. He was saying the optimum testing area would be 1,000 feet above Times Square. In other words, he wanted to know, he said, if we're going to find out what these weapons do, we have to use them on people. And he was adamant about that. Okay? Now, back to this interesting chronology. Again, the day before Port Chicago happens, Oppenheimer writes to James B. Conant saying, and they were meeting in Chicago at that time, saying, you know, we ought to test out the Mark II. August 3rd, Oppenheimer writes to Conant again saying, we're about to get the first fruitful information about the Mark II and how useful it might be. The next day, William Parsons completes his report on Port Chicago, and in particular notes that he was categorizing the damage radii and noting that there was significant amount of damage within the B radius, or 2,500 feet from ground zero. And this was critical because the criterion that had to be met by an atomic weapon to be combat effective, according to the people who were developing it, it had to fulfill the B radius damage area, basically, within 2,500 feet of ground zero. And Parsons' report indicated that, in fact, Port Chicago, the Port Chicago explosion showed significant amounts of damage within the 2,500-foot B damage radius. Then, on August 17th, 1944, another letter from Oppenheimer to Conant recommends that the Mark II be put on the shelf. They said that we now know that that Mark II works. This is a month after Port Chicago. This letter recommends that Mark II, quote, be put on the shelf, unquote. We now know it works, and it can then be taken off the shelf and developed if needed. Though that sentence was the only sentence in an entire two-page document that wasn't redacted when Peter and David Call finally got a hold of this letter. It was a two-page document. All the rest of it was blacked out. Just that one sentence. And that one sentence was a doozy. Again, a month after Port Chicago, Oppenheimer's recommending that the Mark II be put on the shelf because we can always take it back off and use it if needed. Basically, Port Chicago is now, for all intents and purposes, for those who care to recognize it as such, is the first atomic bomb test. It was a Mark II, the only time the autocatalytic uranium hydride implosion weapon, or Mark II, was ever used. It was only developed once. It was a one-of-a-kind nuclear weapon, the crudest of all nuclear weapons, but it was developed and it was used deliberately on American citizens, in this case black sailors, people who were considered to be expendable. I mentioned this because this is an element of American history that most people simply are not aware of. That the first use of an atomic bomb on human beings was not Hiroshima. It was Port Chicago. And that weapon was first used on American personnel, as Parsons wanted, or he didn't necessarily think it had to be Americans, although from a testing standpoint it would have to have been Americans unless they were going to use POWs, because otherwise then it would have been a combat usage. You're going to use it on the Japanese or Germans. But the U-235 weapon was used at Hiroshima. The plutonium weapon was used at Nagasaki. But the Mark II, the autocatalytic uranium hydride implosion weapon, was used at Port Chicago deliberately on American citizens. It's interesting, too, that Peter, through the years, has taken a lot of the old Warman Brown about his Port Chicago investigation. He works at Stanford University, which is a very conservative place. It has a sort of progressive reputation. That may be the students and the good patricians at Palo Alto, but the academic faculty at Stanford is very, very reactionary. And these hard-ass old physics professors whom he has worked with have been openly scornful of his research on Port Chicago, despite the fact that he's done an excellent and heroic job. And they've just poo-pooed the notion that this could have been a nuclear weapon. Finally, when I did a program last July on a community access cable TV show, and then I played the audio track in the South Bay, that convinced even these miserable old Stanford professors and UCal Berkeley professors that, yep, Port Chicago had been a nuke. But even then, the denial sets in, and they said, well, but it was an accidental explosion. Somehow the thing just accidentally went off. Yeah, right. That's why they had a motion picture camera filming this thing from clear across the bay at 10 o'clock on a summer evening. You know, that's not, you're not going to see a whole lot filming an ammunition ship lying at anchor at 10 o'clock in the night being loaded by black sailors from a distance of several miles away. It's just not the hottest thing in the world, aside from the fact that the Navy obviously lied about that, about the type of film. Point being that even though these professors finally had their hash settled with regard to Port Chicago, and they had to come clean, they admitted to Peter, well, you were right. It was a nuke. You know, we're now convinced of you that your research is right. But they wouldn't allow themselves to believe that the weapon was deliberately tested. That they said, eh, what the hell, you know, just blow up a bunch of niggers. We don't give a damn. Let's kill them. You know, let's see what it goes. That's what Parsons wanted to do, and that's what was done. It's interesting that in the realm of conspiracy theory, Parsons, who was very close to Oppenheimer, lobbied very heavily during the McCarthy period against Oppenheimer having his security clearance revoked. And finally it was revoked, and the next day Parsons died of a heart attack. Which may have been a coincidence, and it might have been the stress, too. It was a very stressful time. I suspect, though, that that may have been a deliberately induced heart attack. It's simple to do, even with 50s technology, because once Oppenheimer had his security clearance revoked, Oppenheimer undoubtedly became an extremely unhappy camper, and I wonder how much fear there might have been in official circles. But Jesus, man, now he might start spilling the beans about Port Chicago. What would have happened in the early 50s if Oppenheimer had come clean about Port Chicago and had told the Russians and a bunch of other people, the Soviets, what was really going down? Would have been a tremendous propaganda football. It's interesting that Peter, even today, he was writing to a retired admiral about Port Chicago, and the admiral at first seemed quite receptive to Peter's hypothesis, and then finally Peter got a letter from him after he obtained some documents, and he said, I've reviewed all of these documents, classified, by the way, and I can now assure you that there's absolutely no reason to suspect that Port Chicago was anything other than the conventional explosion that it was. And he then went on, though, to say, and Peter took this as basically laying it between the lines, saying, hey, you know, Peter, you're right, but we can't admit it, saying, can you imagine what would occur if information were to come out indicating that this was an explosion of a nuclear weapon, and imagine how much money it would cost the U.S. taxpayers from the lawsuits from the survivors of this explosion. Well, that basically told Peter why the cover-up was going on, because if, in fact, it came out, the survivors could sue the living hell out of the Navy, and this is why the Navy was covering up. And this is why this admiral was basically telling him between the lines, saying, yeah, Peter, you know, you're right, but we can never admit it. And here's why. See, you don't want the taxpayers. I mean, it's the Navy just didn't want to lose the money. They don't give a damn. They can always get more from the taxpayers. But basically, that's why. Because even now, if this came out, there could be a lawsuit. My interest in Port Chicago is not to get the Navy sued, because basically the Navy isn't going to lose a dime. We're going to lose the money. And while it'd be nice to compensate the victims, at this point, you know, it's a done deal. This was something that occurred over 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm beginning the discussion this evening with Port Chicago, and again, this was the deliberate use of the most ferocious and deadly weapon of war developed in the known history of conflict, And it was developed by us and deliberately used on American citizens, albeit American citizens who were viewed as having second-class citizenship, is because the beat goes on, so to speak. Research and development in the military field has proceeded unabated for a half century. It is very well funded. Much of it is clandestine. And I think we need to take a very good, cold, objective look at some of the military research and development that has taken place in the years since Port Chicago, and beyond that, military research and development that has taken place today. Because if, in fact, some of the weaponry that is on the horizon or actually in existence is going to be seen as viable by the people who are running our national security establishment, it stands to reason that the known history of testing out weapons on unwitting American citizens, either civilians or servicemen, is very likely to be an ongoing history, as above, so below. Beyond that, I find it fascinating to examine some of the military research and development that was going on in the World War II and pre-World War II and immediate post-World War II period, because I think, as I speak, 50 years plus after the end of World War II, we may now be coming to the stage of fruition for the development of military concepts which had been envisioned in the World War II period by the scientists of Nazi Germany, the scientists of Imperial Japan, as well as the scientists working for the United States. What I'm going to do next is to delve back ever so briefly into some of the research and development that was going on in the World War II or immediate post-World War II period, because I think there are some interesting reflections, and that's a brutal pun that you'll understand in a minute, which cast light forward to the present time and which are relevant to our situation today. Now remember the basic concept of what I'm about to read, and also remember the specific instrumentality that is contained in this, because the military thinking of the German scientists who were employed by the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler, who built the V1s and V2s that rained on London, I think is worth taking note of, because I think their basic concepts, although not the specific instrumentalities, but their basic concepts have been nurtured in the post-World War II period. Some of them will seem familiar to people who are familiar with some of the basics of space exploration. But I think in some aspects, for example, of Project HARP, a particularly frightening thing that is, to me anyway, frightening to yours truly, frightening to a lot of other people too. This is something going on right now in Alaska, and I'm going to talk about this a little ways down the road, because I think in certain aspects of what Project HARP appears to be, we may actually be seeing the realization of the military dreams of the Nazi scientists who had built the V1s and V2s and who comprised the core of America's space team in the post-World War II period. Recall that many of these scientists were war criminals. Wernher von Braun, for example, the father of the American space exploration program. Wernher von Braun was an officer in the SS. Not a very nice fellow. What I'm going to do now is read a short section from a book called Project Paperclip, subtitled German Scientists in the Cold War. It's by Clarence G. Lasby, hard and soft cover editions, Athenium Press, 1971. And what we're going to read about here, and again, this is one of the areas in which I'm going to refer directly to text for reasons I've already explained. I think the real value that I have to bring to an inquiry of this type is my understanding of political and historical affairs, and the political and historical analysis I feel quite confident on, although I think I have properly understood the technical texts as far as I'm capable of doing that. I don't want to stray from my own home turf too far, and as I say, I think it would be pretentious and up to a point intellectually dishonest, or past a point intellectually dishonest, for me to hold forth on the technologies themselves past a point. And so for that reason, this will be a more pedantic lecture than most. I'm going to be doing some fairly lengthy reading excerpts for the reasons that I've already explained. Now, what we're going to do now is jump back more than 50 years in time to May of 1945, the immediate aftermath of World War II. Actually, not the immediate aftermath of World War II. World War II is still going on in the Pacific. This is the immediate aftermath of the end of the war in Europe. This is within a couple of weeks of VE Day, the end of the war in Europe. The Staver that you're going to be hearing about here, S-T-A-V-E-R, is Major Robert Staver. Interestingly enough, an individual who acquired his academic credentials at Stanford University, where Peter Vogel has toiled in the catacombs. Staver was one of the top U.S. officers assigned to assessing the technical capabilities of the German rocket scientists. And this is what the German rocket scientists were working on in May of 1945. And I think, although, as I say, I think although the instrumentalities are somewhat different, the basic strategic concepts that were being examined by the German Nazi rocket scientists may very well be seeing the realization in certain respects with Project HARP. So again, May of 1945, Major Robert Staver, and writing to his superiors about the plans by the German rocket scientists. At the same time, Staver proposed another means of ensuring the supremacy of the United States in rocket development. He had listened earnestly as the specialists described their future plans. They would construct an, quote, outer, unquote, station, space station, useful for astronomers and for the launching of spaceships into the stellar regions. They would construct a large reflector for focusing the sun's rays onto the Earth for power generating purposes. The latter could be used as well for another objective, quote, quoting directly from Staver's recommendations, which has been described as a terrible thing, a weapon which will enable the first country to achieve this undertaking to rule the world. The focusing of this reflector upon any living persons would kill them immediately. Ocean water would be instantly turned to steam, a forest instantly kindled, unquote. Impressed by the Germans' advanced thinking and receptive to their expressed desire to continue work in the United States, he urged in a recommendation to the chief ordnance officer in Paris that as many as 100 of them be evacuated within 30 days. Now, this system, as proposed by the Nazi rocket scientists, would have had some huge mirrors, basically, huge reflectors in space to reflect the sun's light onto the Earth for power-generating purposes. In other words, it would have a domestic civilian industrial application. It would also have a military application. And again, these reflectors would focus the sun's rays onto any living thing or any target, incinerating it instantly. So it's a dual-use technology. But basically, it would be a world-controlling, orbital military doomsday system involving orbiting reflectors which could focus the sun's reflected rays on anything on the Earth, destroying it instantly and giving world domination to the power that controlled this particular device. And by the way, although the instrumentality appears to have evolved, as I said, we're going to examine what I think may be the ultimate development of these same strategic concepts with Project HARP. Remember this particular instrumentality, the idea of basically big mirrors in space to reflect the sun's rays, because the closing element of tonight's discussion, we're going to revisit that concept and take a look at what might be a totally irrelevant and somewhat humorous application of same. On the other hand, it might not be totally irrelevant, and it might not be funny at all. But so remember the idea of the mirrors in space focusing the sun's rays. We're going to touch back on that at the end of the discussion. This is what the Nazi scientists were working on in 1945, and one of the things that I think merits serious consideration in terms of the... Well, actually, let's hold off on Nikola Tesla. We're going to take a look at some of the things that Nikola Tesla was working on in the first half of the 19th century, even before World War II. Now, in dealing with the technology of Nikola Tesla, who actually, not Marconi, it was Tesla who invented radio in addition to many other things, we're dealing with technology which has been largely unrecognized by the public as a whole. There are a lot of people who know about what Tesla did. There are indications that some of Tesla's more remarkable discoveries are still basically kept secret, perhaps with military applications. Also, there is a rule of thumb with regard to military research and development in wartime or peacetime. The truth in with regard to military research and development must be surrounded by what Winston Churchill referred to as, quote, a bodyguard of lies, unquote. In other words, in order to deceive an enemy, real or potential, the truth concerning military R&D and the frontiers of military R&D has to be surrounded by disinformation to basically lead a real or potential enemy into chasing a will-o'-the-wisp in, with regard to research and development. When we get to Nikola Tesla, and we're going to get to that in a couple of minutes, I'm going to read from one of Tesla's texts, because again, there's so much disinformation with regard to Nikola Tesla not being qualified in this field. I want to present the information to you as it appears in the literature, and also, quite frankly, to present it to you as a fellow student of this kind of thing, rather than as a Herr Dr. Professor Emery holding down from my lofty position at the University of Heidelberg or wherever. Tesla technology is something I believe I understand up to a point, but not past that point. And I think it is vital to consider some of the things that Tesla looked into. I had had a hunch that Project HARP might actually involve Tesla technology to a certain extent. And my understanding from reading some of the literature on it since is that, in fact, many of the patents do actually draw on Nikola Tesla technology, and that my intuition as an historical researcher in this regard was correct. If that's the case, and it appears that that's the case, the implications of Project HARP could be truly enormous. Something that I spoke about in a lecture at, actually, I guess this would have been in Santa Monica 3 years ago. This would have been the fall of 1992. Something I also alluded to in my lecture this past January called Technology, Theocracy, and the Thousand-Year Reich. Something I also alluded to briefly in the Fun with Science lecture that I gave this past April. And that is the question of so-called UFOs, unquote. Now, in examining the UFO question, it's important to understand that any competent history of the United States 8th Army Air Force's activities in Europe in the closing months of World War II will necessarily have discussion of the so-called Foo Fighters. These were glowing balls which were officially described in communiques by the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force in Europe, or SHAEF, as some sort of revolutionary German anti-aircraft device. Allied airmen saw these glowing balls in the night sky over Germany. They called them Foo Fighters because they appeared to be like fireballs. That was a corruption of the French word feu for foo. It's F-E-U, for fire rather. F-E-U, which in the on the linguistic palates of the Army Air Force personnel became foo, and they called them the Foo Fighters, or feu fighters, or fire fighters, basically like fireballs that were in the sky. And whenever these things appeared, the instruments of the American aircraft went haywire, forcing them to turn back or in some cases crash. There is a lecture about UFOs and the ET myth available again from She Who Remembers, in which I talk about what in all probability were the first so-called flying saucers, basically relatively conventional circular flying machines developed by the Germans during the closing days of World War II. Front page of the New York Times for December 14th, 1944, has a communique from SHAEF, again, Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, saying that these glowing devices being seen by American pilots were some sort of revolutionary new technological anti-aircraft device developed and deployed by the Germans in World War II. It is, of course, fairly well known that the first widely reported UFO sightings were in the immediate aftermath of World War II, but in fact, the first verifiable UFO sightings are those of flying machines that are glowing kraut balls or kraut meteors or Foo Fighters, as the airmen variously called them, spotted by 8th Army Air Force pilots in Europe during the closing months of World War II. Similar devices appeared over Japan later in much smaller numbers during the closing months of the conflict over the air war over Japan. I mention this because there are indications, very, very serious indications, that circular flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere are real, but that they don't come from outer space. There are no ETs. The ET aspect is indeed a myth. And indeed, as I mentioned in my first lecture, the genesis, the first, quote, contactees, unquote, people who allegedly contacted beings from outer space, contact were people like George Adamski and George Hunt Williamson, individuals associated with the Soulcraft organization of William Dudley Pelley, an American Nazi whose Silver Shirt organization was involved with Third Reich espionage in an attempt to overthrow the United States government. After Pelley served 5 years in prison for sedition, basically trying to overthrow the U.S. government, he was released from prison, founded a mystical organization called Soulcraft, drawing heavily, as did his Silver Shirts organization, on the mystical fascist ideology of the I Am organization of Guy and Edna Ballard. And some of the early contactees, the first, quote, close encounters of the third kind were people associated with Pelley's organization. People like Adamski, who met a Venusian, or maybe it was Williamson, who met a Venusian in the desert, right? And this Venusian was tall, with long blonde hair, and fair skin, and blue eyes, just what you would expect from somebody from Venus. Of course, now we know that if there would be any kind of life form on Venus, it wouldn't look anything like what we do. The point is that that's what first interested me in the whole question of UFOs. I don't go in much for a lot of the pop rendition of UFOs. And by the way, a book that I'm going to read extensively from, I'm going to read some long extracts from, a book called Revelations, has nothing to do with the Bible. In fact, it might be a sarcastic takeoff on that. It's by Jacques Vallée, who's done some of the best writing on the political scientific aspects of the UFO question and the ET myth. His book, The Messengers of Deception, and his books, Revelations and Dimensions, are excellent, excellent books. And he does a very effective job of debunking the ET myth. Beyond that, he points out that it appears that the notion that we've been visited by people from outer space is being deliberately propagated and disseminated. Some of the people propagating it are apparently being deceived and are victims of a hoax, but some of them are deliberately spreading disinformation, and that the ultimate source, the ultimate font of the ET myth is the U.S. National Security Establishment, basically the military and the intelligence community, and they are going to great lengths to disseminate the myth that we are being visited by beings from outer space, whereas there is very firm evidence that even if they weren't being developed in the immediate, in the closing months of World War II, there's a very good book called Intercept But Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco that maintains that they were, that whether they, even if they weren't available in the immediate post-World War II period, or perhaps during World War II, that circular flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere are and have been for quite some time a reality, but they don't bloody well come from outer space. There are no ETs, not from the Pleiades, not from Mars, not from any other place. And beyond that, Vallée does an excellent job of debunking the various ET hoaxers. One group blew through town not too long ago. It was in the last couple of years, the Gulf Breeze 6. Military intelligence disinformation effort discussed at considerable length by Jacques Vallée. Also, the Majestic 12 and UMO frauds, and that's basically what they are. Frauds are the wrong words. These are military disinformation efforts. These are what are known as psyops, or psychological operations. Area 51, the same thing. It appears that there are real weird flying machines, but no UFO, no aliens, no ETs. And then, in fact, and Vallée presents a very good presentation of the debunking of these, and he's very kind to some of the people that are disseminating the information. Some of them, he says, are obvious hoaxers, but some of them he thinks are being used and are not aware of the fact that they're being used by military and intelligence people engaged in a deliberate disinformation effort. The same thing with Hangar 18, Roswell. There may very well be things associated with these events, but nothing having to do with people or beings from other planets. It's the ETs that are the hoax. As I stated in my UFO lecture, there is no concrete indication of any kind that there's intelligent life on other planets. Maybe there is, but we have not come in contact with any. There's no concrete, credible evidence at this point of intelligent life on other planets. There's damn little evidence of it on this one, if you stop to think about it. And what's scary, though, is this, is that even though there is no firm indication whatsoever of ETs or contact, on the contrary, there's every indication that these experiences, and he runs through the whole nine yards of the alleged close encounters, including the notion that Hollywood is gradually being used to break us into the idea of aliens and ETs. He debunks that one, too. He says that Hollywood isn't doing anything. He said the military, and specifically at one point the Defense Audiovisual Agency, is very much involved in this, but that Hollywood is not, there's not some great plan afoot to condition us to the notion of ETs, and then we're going to discover that the aliens are really running our government. He debunks that quite effectively. But the thing that's terrifying about what Vallée has to point out is that round, high-tech, circular flying machines are a reality in the Earth's atmosphere. They do not come from outer space. They come from Earth. We make them. We've been making them for a while, but that the very people who are making them, the same institutions that produced Port Chicago, that produced the autocatalytic uranium hydride implosion weapon, the Mark II, also the Mark I, the Mark III, and a lot of other things, and are now working on the Project HARP, are deliberately engaged in a massive, very elaborate, well-funded disinformation effort aimed at deceiving not only the American people, but the whole bloody human race into thinking that we are being visited by people from outer space and that aliens are behind this thing. Now, there are a number of possible reasons for engaging in this disinformation, and basically for engaging in what is known as a PSYOP, or psychological operation. Again, I recommend, among other books, Revelations by Jacques Vallée. It's a softcover edition by Ballantine Books, copyrighted 1991. And what I'm going to examine first, and I'm going to read directly from Vallée's text so that I don't stray too far, because I realize that this type of discussion is highly controversial. I don't know if my ferocious denial of the existence of ETs had to do with that one gentleman leaving there. But boy, when you start puncturing the ET balloon, man, you really step on a lot of toes. And it's something that a lot of people feel very sensitive about. And it's so controversial. Plus, it is so sensationalized with, you know, all these jive TV programs and, you know, and the National Enquirer. And actually, the National Enquirer has some good, although a pretty smarmy reportage. But, you know, you'll see these supermarket tabloids, and you'll be waiting in line. They'll have a notion about how, you know, Liz Taylor was abducted by a UFO and taken down to Waco, Texas, where she saw a vision of Satan as the